Hey friends, welcome to Worry Less, Wag More. This is the Behavior Bets podcast. I'm your host, Ferdy Yao. Join me to dive into the thrills and challenges of treating pet behavior issues. I'll shine a light on science-based training that's effective and brings us closer to understanding the animals we share our lives with. Hey everyone, welcome to the Worry Less, Wag More show. I have my guest, my friend, Amanda Gagnon, who is an anthozoologist, a dog behavior consultant, and a dog trainer. Amanda is a founder and training director at Amanda Gagnon Dog Training in New York City. It's on the Upper West Side in New York City, and she mentors apprentices. She conducts training programs for shelters and rescues, and researches dog-human cultures. Her favorite thing to do is to work directly with humans and dogs during her group classes, private training sessions, and online courses. Amanda is unique in her approach to training because she makes it fun and soulful while introducing people to the science and art of cross-species connection. And I can definitely vouch for that. Amanda is one of the most positive and fun people I know in the dog training world. She always lights up a room whenever you see her come in. She's just wonderful. So we're very, very happy to have you here today, Amanda. How are you doing?
Thanks so much for that lovely introduction. The feeling is so mutual. I always love talking to you, Ferdy. You have such a good energy. I'm great. I'm excited to talk today. Thanks for having me.
Before we dive into our topic about controlling dogs, I want to ask you a little bit more about anthozoology, because there might be a lot of people who don't really know what that is, and maybe there's some young trainers out there who are thinking about going back to school, and they're looking for something to really help their education about dogs and dog and how humans and dogs relate to each other. So can you tell me a little bit about what is anthozoology?
Absolutely. It's a newer field, and I was first drawn to it because I've always been obsessed with the relationship between humans and dogs. So although, of course, that means I'm fascinated by dog behavior, when I was looking at going to graduate school, I would look at all of these different wonderful behaviors on animal behavior specifically, but I always felt like it was missing something that was important to me, which is the human component. So I see humans as animals as well, and anyone who knows me knows that that's a compliment, not an insult. And so when I heard about anthrozoology, which is the study of the relationship between humans and animals, it's so new, in fact, that some schools call it human-animal studies. I like anthrozoology. It has the same meaning, really. But yeah, we're looking at where those species intersect, where they interact, where things cross over. A lot of people look at the conflict. So I have a lot of friends who look at factory farming and the ways that we handle food relationships in our country. I have, of course, many friends who do what I do, which is look at dog-human relationships. And then you also look at animal trafficking. And there's just so many places where humans and animals intersect that need a lot of exploration. And so that's what anthrozoologists do.
Okay. That's really interesting. So you have a master's in anthozoology. And what university did you study, and what kind of courses did you study in school?
It's a really cool program out of Canisius University, which is in Buffalo, New York. So very cold in the winter, very lovely the rest of the year. And I was lucky to find it because I was already running my business at the time. I had a very young baby. And it was a low residency program. And it's still running, and I would recommend it to anybody, because what you do is you go for a week and you do this really intensive week on campus. And what's great about that, as opposed to doing a full online program, is that you really know your instructors, you know your fellow students, you have a connection from that in-person experience, and then the rest of the coursework is online. So I was doing Zoom before Zoom was a thing, and we had a lot of fun with our online courses. And the courses have a pretty good range. It's different from an animal behavior program in that you'll have a few courses on animal behavior and the applied sciences. And like there's an animal cognition course that we had to take and behavior and application courses that we had to take. But also there is animals in religion. There's ethics in animal studies. There's critical animal studies, which is really focusing on those more factory farming topics. How are we using animals? Should animals have rights? What's the difference between rights and welfare? And so you're taking all of those courses to get this really well-rounded approach to the cultural dynamic. And that's the one I left out, of course, is cultural animal studies, which is where I really vibe with cultural animal studies and the history of human-animal relationships, because it's so interesting when we come together and how we relate, especially in those moments where we're competing for resources or when we're working together to gain resources, which is what we get to do with dogs a lot, which is really cool. And then how does it differ? Because a lot of times I think we feel like the way we feel in our culture about animals is the way everyone feels about animals.
Yeah, true. And, yes.
You know, even if we know that that's probably not true, when we cross over cultural lines, we're so passionate about our own belief systems that it's hard for us to be understanding of other cultural communities. And it's also really interesting to look at little microcultures. So you can look, for example, at New York City and see how different dog-human relationships are, even from dog park to dog park, or what's different in the vet's office versus what's happening in the training center versus what's happening at a doggy daycare. And compare that to what's happening in people's homes, and you'll get completely different conversations, completely different mindsets. And so then, of course, imagine if you're now going overseas, if you're going to a country that has a completely different human culture, how do those things fold in with the animals and the environment as well? So that's what I really gravitated toward and did most of my studies. And then, of course, my thesis was on dog-human relationships in Lebanese culture. So I went to Lebanon and I studied all of the different microcultures within Lebanon, which was absolutely fascinating. And I had a wonderful advisor who helped guide me through the process of doing that kind of research study, which I'd like to actually go back and do again, because it was pre-pandemic. And I think everything shifted after the pandemic and a lot has changed there. And when the culture changes, the way we respond and react with the animals around us changes too.
Yeah.
So if we don't understand that cultural dynamic, we're going to overlook a lot of ethical concerns.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that sounds amazing. That sounds like a research paper for you to publish, actually, I'm thinking about.
I should get on top of that.
Yeah, right. But, oh, man, where do you find the time? Because you're also training dogs in New York City. And so I'm interested, how do you find, like, your background in anthrozoology, how's that helped you in your dog training career?
You know, it's such an interesting question, because it's not anthrozoology. We don't focus as much on the applied sciences, and dog training is so much about application in the field.
Yeah.
But the way that it has impacted me has a lot to do with my overall approach. And the best way to explain it is to give you an example, which is I really think about the way we interact with dogs differently since I've started studying anthrozoological components. Because when you go into another country and looking at that dog-human relationship and seeing what other options there are available changes things a lot. When people say, hey, is it okay for my dog to be off-leash in this context? Is it okay for my dog to be on the couch? And I think a lot about, and we're going to talk quite a bit today, I think about the types of freedoms I think are okay. And I can give people examples from other cultures. And then the other major way that it's impacted my boots on the ground dog training is that I am able to understand the research in the field a lot better than I could before. I was taught how to read the studies and how to analyze. I had to take a statistics class and I had to think about those things. Whereas before, if you don't study how to read the research, you're really reliant on other people's take, which can be perfectly fine for understanding it, but you're able to be a lot more creative and even to be a little bit more critical when you're reading research once you understand how to look at it, which I really appreciate a lot.
That's, I can relate to what you're saying there. I think it's definitely very interesting reading these papers, and I always feel like the general public is about 10 years behind like the science. So when you start reading new papers and new findings about what's going on in dog behavior and dog training, a lot of times you don't really see the application until years later. But now that, you know, when you have a better understanding of reading these papers critically, I feel like I'm able to apply things that, if it makes sense for me, you know, like right away, almost right away, and really try to use some of the most like progressive and cutting edge science that we're learning and that's coming up.
100%.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So cool. And I love that perspective of like of studying other cultures. I think that's such a, it's something that I think people wish more people did, because there are definitely so many other models as we're going to get into right now. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about our topic, which is about controlling dogs. But before I dive into and ask you the first question, I'm just going to came up with some statistics, some data here. There are estimated to be between 700 million to 1 billion dogs worldwide, and over 70% of these dogs are free-ranging dogs. So essentially, our model here in the United States, especially up here in the Northeast, you know, of having owned pets, we are really in the minority. I know you just came back from a trip, and I'd love to hear a little bit more about it, where you probably saw a lot of dogs, street dogs. But I also know there's this great documentary came out a few years ago. It was called Stray. You've probably seen that movie, right?
Yes.
And it was filmed in Turkey. And what I learned from that movie is that documentary is that Turkey has a no-kill, no-capture policy towards all stray animals. So there are a lot of street dogs living in the cities and villages. Whereas in New York, where we live, any stray dog is captured by animal control or the police, and they're removed off the streets and brought into a shelter or a rescue. So very, very different ways of looking at dogs. So can you tell me a little bit about, how about we talk about the history of controlling dogs, and in what ways do we control dogs?
Yeah, that's really, really great information. And I, you know, the first time I heard that statistic that you just quoted there, that 70% or more, was actually from Ray Coppinger when he was doing a tour. And I want to dwell on it for a second because it really blew my mind. And I think a lot of people don't know that most of the world's dog population is free roaming in our culture. And I had been training dogs for years before I heard him give that lecture, and he threw that out like a side. It was just a piece of information. And I don't think I heard the rest of his talk because I was like, wait a second. I go, what? What do you mean? How are we going to save all those dogs? It was literally my first thought.
Yes.
And what I think is really was an important learning for me is that we have to question what a good life looks like for a dog, just the same way we would with humans, that we don't always know what a good life looks like in another culture. And so we have to really, it's okay to be critical of other cultures, but you really have to do that with an understanding that you don't always know exactly what you're looking at from the outside. I really love that you brought up that statistic. And the history is really interesting in the US because, of course, back before there were dog catchers and dog shelters, and even before, if you rewind back far enough, all dogs were free roaming dogs. And it's interesting to think about because in our culture, we tend to think of all of our mutts as hailing from some regal ancestry of purebred dog. And so we get, you know, genetic testing and things like that. And we go, okay, you know, Fluffy here is half golden retriever and half doodle and half this or a quarter this. Great math there, obviously. But getting to what their genetic ancestry is. And the truth is that every dog hails from a dog someplace historically that has no purebred genetic lineage whatsoever. And that all of the purebred dogs, including the working breeds, were a result of the relationship between humans and dogs, either through just our compatible natures, right? So going back to pastoral times when we started domesticating sheep, for example, most likely, and of course we can't peer back through history entirely accurately, so it's worth mentioning that we glean what we can, and I'm making some assumptions as I go through here based on what's been able to be uncovered by researchers. But bones can't talk, so there might be some errors in this. But most likely, you know, you're a herder, you're in the field with your shepherd, you're in the field with your sheep, and you have dogs around. And there's a dog or two that's very helpful. They ward off predators. They protect your sheep. Maybe they bark when an intruder comes in, and you start to really like that dog. And that's probably a dog that also isn't inclined to attack your sheep. So you think, wow, this is a great dog. And initially, it might have been as simple as just feeding that dog more of your scraps. And then that dog starts breeding with another dog. It has more of a chance of genetic success because we like them better, kind of as simple as that. And I wouldn't call that control as much as interaction. But the next step beyond that, I think of as humans starting to control what dogs look like and how they behave more intentionally, which is to decide who gets to breed and who doesn't. And it isn't until the 1800s, and this is significant because we've been friends and cohabitating and relating with dogs most likely for between 15 and 30,000 years. So we're going back tens of thousands of years. And it isn't until very, very recently that we started saying, hey, look, it's interesting. If we breed a small dog with a small dog, we get an even smaller dog and just start doing it just for looks. Or just because we found a particular trait interesting. And this is when we start getting into genetically controlling dogs very intentionally. And so No topic of control is complete without thinking about how this is a very intimate way of controlling an animal species and how it evolves. And we've done it with other species. You know, we talk about domestication. We control what types, which cows get to breed together and which pigs. But with dogs, it's been for very different reasons. And I think that's a very interesting thing to think about. And I think in modern time, we should be thinking a lot more about what the reasons are. And I personally don't think breeding for looks alone has been good for dogs as a species, because it has a lot of behavioral fallout, which can cause some problems. And then once looking at genetic control is one piece of it, then we also have to look at behavioral control, physical control, and population control. So your question was about the history, and I think that population control is something that's been happening for a long time. And so that's kind of one big subject to look at, and it's the one that's the hardest to look at because population control at least seems necessary in a lot of places. If there are so many dogs that we're having a lot of human-dog conflict, where people are getting hurt, where there's disease transmission, where things that we don't tend to think about unless we've been to a place with a lot of free-roaming dogs is noise pollution. So there are a lot of barking in some of these places. So thinking about the reasons behind population control and how we manage that, and I think as Westerners, we don't always realize how much population control we do in our country because it's out of sight, out of mind. And
yeah, exactly.
Right. So when we started to have population control measures, culling measures, it wasn't so out of the realm of human thought. We weren't so opposed to violence. I think violence was more of a part of the human reality. In the 1700s, the 1800s, we saw our animals get butchered. We knew what we were eating. We were in direct contact with stray dog populations, and we knew what some of the problems were. And there are probably a lot more people who didn't like dogs or saw dogs as vermin. And so we started cleaning the streets of all the stray dogs. And there are some pretty dark measures that were taken. Famously, New York City, and close your ears if you don't want to hear this, trigger warning. But famously in New York City, they would round dogs up and push them into cages and then drown them in the East River. And I mean, as much as 800 dogs at a time. And there's pictures of this, and you can read articles about it. And it's pretty.
When was this going on?
That was early I want to say 1877 would be okay. The article that I've read. Yeah, so late 1800s. And then also in the 1800s, there was a whole group of people who really cared about dogs and didn't like this. And that's when all the humane societies started to be formed. You see it in England happening first. So I think it's a really interesting moment in history for dog-human culture, that middle 1800s, where while people are starting to breed for looks, and some dogs are starting to gain this kind of royal top of the hierarchy status, where they can live in the home and be in the bed and sit in our sleeves and keep us warm, and they're pretty and we compete with them, we tie bows around their heads. Or you've got your hunting dogs, which also were held in high esteem, your war dogs held in high esteem, but your stray dogs, well, those were vermin. Those needed to be killed. This is a huge shift in the dog-human relationship, and it set the course for all the way up until present day, because as these humane societies were formed, they started to care about how we were culling the dogs, how we were treating the dogs. And then this set at odds, this kind of polarized divide where, yeah. Okay, on the one hand, dogs are base and vile and dirty and need to be controlled. And on the other hand, dogs are wonderful and beautiful and we need to protect them and keep them safe. And then you can see that over the years, that humane society perspective kind of wins the day in the minds of the zeitgeist of Western culture. So, and even to the point where we started seeing a lot of progress in the 1900s, late 1900s, this is like my childhood, like 1990s and 1980s, people really cared about how we treated dogs. People really cared about, oh my goodness, we kill how many dogs a year in this country? How can we bring those numbers down? And I don't think everybody knows what those numbers were, but it was in the millions. And so everybody doesn't know that. And there are pretty amazing people who trailblazed bringing the numbers of euthanized dogs down in our culture to the point where now I think we're closer to 400,000 a year, which it's still a huge number, but it's a lot smaller. But somewhere in that conversation, we lost a little bit of perspective, and we needed, what we started to think was that no dog should ever be outside of a house. Mm-hmm. And that if that was the case, that dog always needed to be rescued. And I think sometimes a free roaming dog does need to be rescued and sometimes it doesn't. And that it's not necessarily something we can put a blanket statement over. So that was how these things sort of evolved. And then the other thing that's important to mention in terms of control historically is there was a really cool arc, really interesting arc in how we started to establish behavioral control over dogs. Because now that all the dogs are in our house and we start enacting leash laws because once you say no dog can ever be roaming free, well, now you have to control where they go. So we start implementing leash laws. We start implementing all dogs have to be inside the house. There's a lot of states have a no dogs at large law in place. So you're not allowed to have your dog running free. And it's left up to the state. So you'll see varying degrees of enforcement and varying degrees of how strict this is. But if you look at our hometown of New York City, it's a 6-foot leash law. So dogs have to be on the end of the rope all the time. Well, what happens there is dogs develop behavior problems because dogs naturally need a lot of them. They need a lot of exercise. They need mental stimulation. They need physical stimulation, just like most animals. And there are very dog-specific needs. And if we're always controlling their behavior, sometimes behavior problems crop up. And so now there's a huge industry of dog toys and dog professionals like you and me who can teach you how to control your behavior. And you get different types. You get some people who are controlling behavior through force and coercion, and you get some people who are trying to find ways to control behavior through relationship building, positive associations, and everything in between, which is its own type of control. And the history of that can be looked at all by itself. We can look at where did the origins of aversive training come from and how did that evolve and when did it work and when did it not? And then who kind of pushed back against that? Because the aversive control all comes from the war of wars. So those were the trainers who were training dogs to be in battle. Mm-hmm. And then they came okay. out of that and started teaching people how to make their dogs battle ready, which is totally different from what we're actually doing with dogs in homes. So there's just so much to unpack
with a pet dog. Yeah. wow. There's so many different directions to go there.
So much to unpack.
Yes, so I'm like, where do we go from here? But you know what? Since you just mentioned the training, and that's actually one of the questions I had for you, and I think you just touched on it. You just really explained that really well. Why are working dogs more strongly associated with training that focuses on dominance and control versus trainers who are using more, you know, building relationships and trust? So it seems like the working dogs that originally kind of came from the military, the wartime training, that type of stuff. Is that how it kind of evolved?
And when you say working dogs, do you mean police dogs and war dogs, or are you?
Yes,
talking...
I kind of mean like police dogs, war dogs, hunting dogs, you know, things like that, or even herding dogs.
Yeah, you know, there's something interesting in our culture that I think bleeds across multiple conversations. And it's a polarization that's idea-based. So I think there's almost a right-wing, left-wing thing that happens in the working dog community. Not always, but you do see there is a tendency toward ensuring, I almost want to compare this to parenting, right? So even in parent, like if you think about this in terms of parenting, there is a style of parenting where a certain amount of dominance and control is thought as necessary in order to create resilience in the child. And then there's a kind of a counterpoint of parenting that says that that's never necessary and that you should always be gentle. And I think you see that play out a little bit with dogs. I think it's misplaced when we're talking about dogs. It's there's some similarities, but I don't love to draw parallels between children and dogs because the truth is adult dogs aren't children. So treating them as if they're all toddlers takes away some of their agency, and it's really important to me to help dogs have agency. But yeah, I think a lot of that working dog culture draws its roots from that military style of training. You're talking about Conrad Most, right? And then moving forward in history, there was William Kohler, which his book is absolutely terrifying when you read the beginning. Like, I don't know if you've read his book, but I love to read books that disagree with me or that show me different cultural examples of how we relate with dogs, even if I disagree, because it deepens my understanding. Either I'm exposed to something new that I can then fold in, or I'm exposed to something that helps me understand what I already believe. So if you look at like William Kohler, he talks about teaching a dog class where there are several people. He calls them wincers. Wincers. So whatever he's doing in that class is so dramatic with the dogs that it makes people wince and draw back.
Oh, he's talking about the people. Oh, jeez.
Yeah, the people are wincers. So he's telling them all, presumably, to do some sort of collar correction, choke, dominating behavior. But it's strong enough that the people are going, oh, dear, and they're grimacing and leaning, you know. And he has two or three people walk right out of his class. And he uses that in his mind to support his method of training. He's saying, if I had two people walk right out of my class, I would be examining my methods. If I still found them sound, but it's called to question, why am I driving people right out of the room? What am I doing? That's not his response at all. His response is, that's right, you wincers, get out of here. You can't handle the truth. And I think that's an inherited perspective in a lot of cultures of working dogs. Not everywhere. There are plenty of people using really great scientifically sound techniques now. But there is some pushback there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, that your story about the wincers, that just reminds me of a client who recently, it was just a few months ago, told me about a trainer that they worked with. It was a trainer that that the shelter, their rescue, I shouldn't say shelter, the rescue group had recommended to work with this rescue dog that they had adopted. And apparently he said, okay, women and children need to leave the room right now. And then he was just him and the husband of the family. And you can only imagine, you know, what was going on there. Yeah. So that winter story. Yeah. That's, you know, it's scary to me that's still going on. But
there's so much wrong with that. Like there's sexism component.
Oh my God. Yes. There's so many layers of wrong that is. And you know, that's scary, layers. But unfortunately it's still prevalent in our culture. Mm-hmm. But I want to ask you, because another question that you brought up that I think is really important. And you just brought it up. You talked about breeding for looks or appearance. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that is something we see a lot here in the New York mm-hmm. City area, where it seems like literally every other dog is some sort of doodle mix, some sort of poodle mix, a cavapoo, labradoodle, golden doodle, you know, something. So what kind of problems can come up when we start just breeding for looks and appearance? And what does that say about our relationship with dogs?
Well, the bottom line for me is that it really undervalues who dogs really are and what they can be for us. Anytime you're trying to completely control another soul, that's not really love, is it? And I think it's really worthy of saying and putting a really heavy point on the fact that I love many, many, many purebred dogs. Some of my best friends in the world are purebred dogs. And that includes all the doodles and all the things. So when I talk about this, I'm not talking necessarily about individual relationships. And it's really important for people to understand that. A dog who is here and in front of you is a dog and is beautiful. What I'm talking about is irresponsible or unexamined creation of dogs without really thinking through what is best for them as a breed or as a species. That's what I'm talking about. And so I think in that vein, I think that people are failing to love dogs as dogs and missing out on the connection that's really possible by trying to create something else. So we say, oh, I want to make a dog that's hypoallergenic, just talking with something that's really easy to think about. Well, that makes sense because a lot of people want to have dogs who won't trigger their allergies, right? That makes sense. Mm-hmm. But it's actually misleading because those dogs aren't hypoallergenic. They just don't shed as much as other dogs. And in doing that without thinking about everything else, so if you have a family that wants a dog that's hyperallergenic and you're breeding it just for that. And then that dog, in order to get that dog, you bred together dogs that are going to make it more likely to bark all the time or be really high energy or have other types of behavioral problems. You're only thinking about one aspect instead of thinking about the whole dog. And I think humans try, though nature might, to teach us this lesson, we have a really hard time accepting that we are not as good as Mother Nature at evolution.
Yeah.
We simply aren't, and we can try to lean in that direction. But if you're going to decide which life gets to get created by picking which dogs breed, you should be absolutely obsessed with thinking about every variable possible here and taking total responsibility. So instead of breeding just for hypoallergenic or just for curly and cute, which is far more common, okay, at least hypoallergenic, mm-hmm. I feel like has a
purpose behind it.
Purpose, yeah, there's an ethical concern there and a reason. But if you're just, oh, how cute can this dog be? Dogs are all cute. Have you ever had a dog that wasn't cute? Even ugly dogs are so ugly they're cute. Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
So let's breed for health and let's breed for behavioral wellness. And even when you do that, if I take two dogs that I think, I mean, they're old enough to have shown a reasonably good report card on the health front, and they're especially if the male is a little bit older and we can see that they're friendly and sociable, they're going to fit well into human society, because we're asking dogs to live in a house. That's not their natural environment, and that's okay, but we should be thinking about what's the behavioral fallout of just breeding for the biggest dog, or the dog with the biggest jaw, or the squish-nosed dog? What's the health fallout? Because failing to do that produces really complicated problems down the road. And I know, like, someone got a paycheck for it. And a lot of this is done very innocently and naively. It's not all puppy mills and bad news stuff. It's actually often just people don't know that this should be a consideration.
I love that you brought that up. That is such an important point. I think it's I actually looked this up. Because I was thinking about biophilia. So This is a term that Edward O. Wilson, the great biologist, had coined. And biophilia is our innate tendency to focus upon life and lifelike forms, and in some instances, to affiliate with them emotionally. So that was what Edward O. Wilson had talked about biophilia. It's our love of nature. And you're talking about how we can love something, but we want to control it. And as opposed to, you know, as my, my background in conservation biology, like, I love tigers, you know, like that was always my favorite animal growing up. And I don't feel a need to control, to have a tiger, a pet tiger. I wouldn't ever want that. It fulfills me. It makes me happy that to know that tigers exist in this world and they are living somewhere wild. So I love what you said, you know, about, you know, if you really love something, you know, can you really control it, you know, or what you said? I forget exactly what you said, but if you are just always trying to control something, do you really love it, right? So is that the true test, if you truly love something, that you're able to let it go or let it be and
honestly, yes. Now, I mean, to me, it's very obvious. If you really love something, you love all of it. The things you like and don't like, right? Liking and loving aren't the same. Like, love is a full acceptance of who somebody else is, and in this case, who another animal is. So when my dog barks or behaves in ways that are irritating to me, I still love him, right? Yeah. But it gets a little... where it really gets, and it's easy to, I think, not easy for everyone, but easy for me to wrap my mind around, okay, he's being a little reactive because he feels uncomfortable. I still love him. I love the whole dog. Where I think it gets sticky is in safety concerns when we're talking about control. And I don't think there's a lot of gray area here. There's not a black and white answer. So it's actually poignant to use the cliche, if you love something, let it go. Because we can't let our dogs go, or they'll run into the street and get hit by a car. So it's kind of fun to think about, oh, there's all these free roaming dogs in the world, and there are some populations that get to run around and do what they want and eat what they want and copulate and have a great life. You know? But in the culture we're in right now, if we opened all of our doors and let our dogs run out, it would be tragic. Just have to be honest. Like, that's really not something.
There are obviously risks with that, right? Like overpopulation, rabies, dogs getting hurt, just running out in traffic, and aggression and nuisance behaviors. So, you know, it's a balance, right? Like, so can you speak to that of, you know, if when we need to have control over dogs, what's the most humane and ethical way of doing so? And how can we give our dogs more freedom?
That's such a great question. And I think the first thing to focus on is a paradigm shift, which we've already been talking about a bit. seeing our dogs as agents who have their own mind, as fully grown adult animals who are capable of so many things. And I think that people naturally gravitate toward this. Even thinking about Morocco, the trip that I just got back from, if you watch, one of my favorite things to do in a country with a big free roaming dog population is watch the dogs cross the street. Because yeah. I just love, and people love hearing these stories. You see a dog, you know, they get up from their nap, wherever, they stretch, they walk out between cars, and they look both ways. And they make sure there's no car coming, and then they trot across. People love the story of the dogs in Moscow who ride the train and get off at the right stop and go and get some food, and then they get back on the train and go back to where they live. And because dogs are capable of having so much agency. And those stories help us to open our mind to looking at our dogs as capable. Because as long as you look at a dog as a helpless creature, not when they're a puppy, when they're a baby, they are a little helpless. But very quickly, by 5 months old, they're capable of a lot of cool things. And so if you look at your dog as being capable, having agency, being sentient, being capable of making choices, and that can open your mind to providing them with so much more than you might otherwise. For example, I love seeing trainers online teaching people how to do preference tests, right? Lay out a bunch of treats and see which ones your dog eats first, and now you know what he likes. You can ask your dog what he likes. If you're going on a walk, because for a long time it was all about make this military style training, encourage people to make your dog walk behind you and never let them show you who's boss. I mean, it's just rubbish. Why not? If he wants to go right, I don't care if we go right or left. Let's go right today. My dog just made a choice. That little paradigm shift in giving your dog more choice, it creates a better life for your dog. It helps you love them on a deeper level and know them on a deeper level. And bonus, it actually provides a type of mental stimulation and physical, I think, satisfaction, to use a very unscientific term, that reduces behavior problems. Yes. So it's good for everything. Yeah. So I think starting with that paradigm shift and giving choice, and the close follow-up to that for me is, and this is just the easy stuff you can do today, let your dog be a dog. And as much as you can, wherever you can. So that means that sometimes they get dirty. Dogs love to be dirty, right? They love to roll in poop as much as we love to spray on perfume. I'm not saying you have to let them roll in poop, but like, let them be dirty sometimes. Let them bark sometimes. And I have honestly seen dogs in my own clientele where it's like, why don't you just let them bark for a minute? Why don't you join him in the barking? And you can watch this look wash over the dog's face. There's absolute and utter confusion. That their human is, are you barking with me? They'll go silent for the first time ever. Just out of bewilderment. And then the joy that you see in the dog that their human friend has just joined them and having some fun is indescribable. And so you get this increased connection between the human and the dog. And the dog gets to express one of their natural tendencies. And then what follows is you actually get more desirable behaviors. And so you can think of it less about controlling the dog and more about giving the dog outlets to be a dog, so that when you need them to be acceptable in a human environment, they can be, right?
Yeah, it's awesome you bring this up. This is one of my biggest points about shelter, training dogs in the shelter, that instead of focusing on behavior modification and teaching loose leash walking or sit down, stay, my argument these days, which I'm just trying to tell everybody, I'd love to hear what you think, is put that aside, and you should prioritize. I'm not saying don't do that type of training, but I'm saying the priority should be get the dogs out and let them be a dog. Let them feel like a dog. I literally said the other day, I let the shelter dog roll around and poop or whatever it is, disgusting, a dead carcass. I'm like, you know, I have a seat protector in my car. That's fine. You know, I can always put that in the laundry. And I want the dog to feel like a dog and to feel joy, to get out of that shelter, get out of that kennel, and mm-hmm. and really fight that kennel stress. So I'd love to, love to hear your thoughts on that.
I think that's absolutely on target. It's the amount of that type of discomfort you can tolerate. Like, I'll let my dog get in the car covered in poo. That is the happiest dog life I can imagine. Like, that dog is like, yes, he will let me roll in a dead raccoon. That's amazing. And then, you know, there's soap. It's okay. Yeah. We can have a bath. I absolutely agree that a lot of times, even those of us who do more reinforcement-based training and we really think about always trying to use rewards, we can become so overscheduled and overstructured and agenda focused that we forget to really just let them be who they are. And it's something that can be, especially if you're doing private training, it can be difficult to help people see because it sounds so simple. It's like, why don't you just go and sit with your dog in the park? I think you guys have you ever come in behind a trainer and the people have been working so hard because they love their dog, like a dog with reactivity, for example, and they've just been training and training and training, and the dog, what they've absorbed from it sometimes is the stress of the need to be something other than what they are. And a lot of times the best first assignment is, why don't you guys just decompress? Go and sit down in the park and watch the world go by and just let it be. And then we can implement things a little more slowly and more sustainably. Sometimes just doing that, you'll see problems dissolve because you give people permission to not control it as much, right? Dogs are naturally reactive. Your dog isn't a bad dog. They just can't fit into the society we put them in. So let's give them a little time. It's not to say we're not going to fix any dangerous problems. It's just that sometimes that understanding alone can shift things dramatically.
Yeah, I think we're taught from such an early age of you have to control the dog. The dog has to be perfect, and they have to behave in a certain way. So that's such an important message. I love that how we're just flipping that whole message on its head and telling people, let your dog can walk in front of you. It's okay. Let them lead. Let them choose the direction. They're not going to say, oh, I'm your boss now all of a sudden when you allow them to do that.
Exactly.
Okay, let me ask you this. So you traveled you traveled a lot, through your life and your studies, and you watched dogs in different cultures. Now, what are some things that you wish we did more here that you've seen in other places?
The number one thing jumps right into my mind. The number one thing that I wish we did more is allow dogs access to public spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to Spain, and this is anecdotal, right? But you'll see dogs off leash, they're going out to the bars. We're going out for tapas. There are dogs everywhere, under the table, in people's laps. Nobody's worried about this. And even when you see a dog, a little moment of reactivity, which, by the way, you don't see as often. Again, anecdotally, I don't see as much reactivity on the streets. I think it's because the dogs have more freedom to move and respond.
Now, are these stray dogs or are these pet dogs?
These are pet dogs. Okay. Yeah, and they're allowed to go wherever they want. I had a really fun moment observing a tiny little dog with a man who it was this he almost looked like a hippie biker. It was like leather clad, long, gray, disheveled hair. He looked like the type of guy who spends all day at a pub. And he's kind of like walking down the street, and I see this little dog running around all by itself. Eventually, I realize these two people are together. They're like a total mismatch, and it's wonderful. And while this guy goes and leans on a bar, and he's getting a beer and ordering some tapas, this little dog is making the rounds. You can tell he does this all the time. He goes all the way up the street, pees on something, crosses the street, says hi to another dog that's on leash, comes back around, gives me a little sniff, goes back to his human and sits and keeps an eye on the world. You see so much of that. If you saw that in New York City, you would have people raising alarm bells all over the place. Oh, that dog is off leash. Oh, that, that irresponsible human. He's going to get hit by a car. I mean, this dog was fine. They did this all the time. Now, is there some risk there? Yes, but is it worth the payoff? That's kind of my question. And it's a question. Right? There are pros and cons to this. But I wish we could give more access to public spaces. And I'll give you one other example that I find interesting. Years ago, I was called on by, I think it was Good Morning America, wanted me to do an interview because there was a famous actress who had been caught on video with her dog in the car. Right. And, you know, every year in the summer, there's all kinds of media. Don't leave your dog in a hot car, which I think we all know. Don't leave your dog in a hot car. But in the video, someone takes a very short video of her dog in the car, and then you see her coming out of the dry cleaners with her dry cleaning. I mean, it was a minute, maybe. She's coming out with her dry cleaning. And so for me, I can fill in the blanks. I know what happened. She is going to pick up her dry cleaning, and she can't take her dog inside. So for me, the problem isn't that she left her dog in the car for all of 2 minutes. The problem is, why can't she bring her dog into the dry cleaners? Why can't, what's the problem? Is someone going to get dysentery? Like, what's wrong with that? Why can't we bring dogs at least into outdoor restaurants? I think even indoor restaurants. And if you, the medical professionals I talked to about this and the write-ups I've seen from the veterinary community, it suggests that there really isn't that much danger of disease transmission unless a dog jumps on a table and pees in your soup, which, yeah. No, don't eat it. Right? Like, maybe ask that dog to leave. But like you saw in New York City, they used to have a law that dogs couldn't even be in the terraces outside restaurants. And for any listeners who haven't been to New York City and aren't familiar, the terraces of restaurants are actually just roped off pieces of sidewalk. So, yeah. If you were sitting at a restaurant, what people would do is line their dogs up along the outside of the rope, as if that's any different than being inside the rope, outside the rope.
Exactly.
And then finally, they passed a law allowing us to all bring our dogs inside the rope. They moved 1 foot to the left. And I think it was helpful because people are faced with a choice between leaving their dog at home for unreasonable amounts of time or violating the law or leaving them in the car. And it shouldn't be against the law to take your dog into a retail store where there's no danger. I think that would help dogs a great deal. That's the thing I see the biggest.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I see that. I agree with that. And I'm always looking for dog-friendly beaches and stuff like that to take my dog to.
Let them off leash. But, you know, there's a human responsibility that comes with that, right?
Yeah.
You have to know your dog. And I think people worry a lot about the lowest common denominator, right? The lowest, the least responsible human being.
Yes.
But in my experience, those people let their dogs off leash in illegal places anyway. You're not at all that you're doing is hindering the law abiding citizens who are more responsible with their dogs most of the time.
Yeah. there's so much that we can dive into in this topic, and there's just not enough time. I would love to, let me ask you this question here, and I want to ask you about your book, okay, that you're writing. But this question is, you've been studying the history of the human dog or the dog human relationship, and where do you see it evolving now, you know, compared to where it was at before and with our modern day pressures now? Where do you see it evolving now?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm an optimist by nature. So I'm going to give an optimistic answer, but I'm going to ground it in some trends that I'm seeing. One of my favorite trends right now is consent-based dog training applications. And so people are really thinking, both in a human context and in a dog context, in a lot of areas, how can we respect the space of other people? How can we respect our dogs more? I think people are starting to think about this more. People are publishing books about how to give dogs choices. People are thinking more about having a harmonious relationship that isn't black and white. And so I think that we're coming up on a bit of a culture war within the dog training community. I really see things kind of coming to a head between the idea of using less aversive measures and more aversive measures. And there really are some parallels in the political zeitgeist of our country that are really fascinating that someone could do a dissertation on. Oh, so I think things are coming to a head there, and we're going. But what I hope that will do is produce a lot of really interesting conversations and really creative experimentation with how we can do better for our dogs and continue to go in what I think is a direction that is more humane than it was for the last couple hundred years, and that offers some solutions to some of the conflicts and problems that we tend to focus on trying to solve. I really think that we're going to start giving our dogs a little bit more freedom, a little bit more choice, that people are starting to understand the breeding problems, and that we might get more creative and healthier in how we allow dogs to procreate. And I also think, at least I hope, that in the rescue world, we're getting better at focusing on behavioral wellness than we used to be. And so there's a lot of good things happening. And I think what I hope people can do to speed the plow on this is try not to anchor down and get stuck in a viewpoint that is so passionate that you discount all other viewpoints and that you shut people down from speaking their mind. I think a lot of dog professionals these days are scared to say what they think, because there's a lot of backlash. And I hope that we can all be super tolerant and welcoming and work together for our common purpose, especially when we disagree, because that's where really cool solutions are going to sprout. Yeah.
That's a great answer. Thank you for saying that. Okay, so let's talk about your book. You're writing a book. You're working on a book. Do you have a release date yet?
No, I don't. Okay. I'm definitely on the slow train of writing a book because of how much I have going on. I'm a person who has a lot of projects and loves to do so many things, and I tend to do them all at once. And so, no, we don't have a release date yet. We are working through the editing process right now. But my book is called, working title right now, Dog Trust. A lot of the things we talked about today are in the book and so much more. The first half of the book is about the history of the dog-human relationship. And I really think that we have an innate relationship of trust, an innate bond with dogs because of how old our relationship is. The human-dog relationship, there's nothing to match it in the animal kingdom, nothing. In recent history, some of that trust has really broken down, mostly because of misunderstandings and because of population pressures on both sides that have caused conflicts to increase. And I have a lot of suggestions for how we can repair that, how we can have a better relationship with our dogs and allow that trust kind of to give it free rein again. We don't have to mistrust our dogs. We don't have to try to control them in some of the ways we've talked about today. And that's what the book focuses on. It's a labor of love.
I love it. Yeah, thank you. You're so fascinating to talk to. I'm really looking forward to reading your book. It's, I think it's going to be really, really interesting. So
thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. So where can people find you?
Online, you can find us, AmandaGagnonDogTraining.com. The spelling of my name, I'm sure, will be in the show notes.
Yes, it will.
I have some things coming up this year with the Association of Professional Dog Trainers. So if you're a professional trainer and you want to collaborate or be a student, I have a few things coming up. I'm teaching a course on puppy kindergarten and how to run a great one. I've got another course coming up this summer, and I'll be presenting at the conference this fall. So you can find me there too.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. All right. So that's Amanda Gagnon, the anthropologist and dog trainer and everything else that she does. It's just amazing. Thank you so much for your time. I really, really enjoyed having you here.
Thank you, Ferdy. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. You're just the best.
Hey, animal lovers. Thank you for joining us. If you enjoyed what you heard and like to learn more, please follow us on Facebook or visit www.behaviorvet.com. We have much more cool stuff for you if you'd like to keep geeking out on companion animal behavior with the Behavior Vets team. Come back soon and join us on our journey to make life better for the animals in your life. Thanks again for listening. Remember to have hope because real change is possible and we can achieve it together. Enjoy our podcast, but this is a reminder that the contents of this podcast are for educational and entertainment purposes only. The comments and advice are never intended to be a substitute for seeing a behavior professional or a credentialed veterinarian in person. While the content is always intended to help people receive the best possible behavior support for their pets, any information you utilize from this podcast is at your own risk.